Morning. We begin our session today with 00-1426-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John Miller Carroll. Mr. Carroll is appearing and will argue for 25 minutes. Julie M. Falk, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation, will have 30 minutes. And, Mr. Carroll, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and I say that this is the time allotted to you. You need not feel that you have to take all of your time. That's not held against you if you don't.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. As the Court is well aware, this case involves an attorney discipline reinstatement proceeding. As you know, the factual findings in these cases are very fact-intensive. The decision that the referee issued in this case, I don't believe was as carefully thought out as it could have been. I just briefly would like to touch on the issues as they relate to the errors in the decision. Essentially, the facts were undisputed at the hearing. There were two issues that the referee found as a basis for a denial of the reinstatement petition. Every other element essentially was met in terms of the reinstatement. The first one was moral character. The first error that the referee made in this was he cited the reinstatement questionnaire as the reinstatement petition. Those are two distinct documents. One is the petition that I filed to initiate the action. The other is a standard form that's used by OLR for attorneys to respond to. So in the first paragraph of the decision, he's starting with a supposition that simply has no basis in reality. In any event, whether that was a typographical error or not, doesn't really matter. The questionnaire that he's referring to essentially contains a section which asks, and this is really a discovery device for OLR, to list the names of references, and essentially I think they contact by letter these people. We listed 5 people as witnesses. At the time, I had formerly practiced in Milwaukee and Racine counties, but I'd handled cases pretty much all over the state. I made a decision when I knew the suspension was going to take place that I was going to move, and we currently live in Waupaca County. So I had very little contact while the suspension was going on with lawyers in the Milwaukee area. I did list 2 witnesses in the Milwaukee area, 3 witnesses from the Milwaukee area that they contacted. None of them stated that I didn't have the moral character to have my license reinstated. The 2 witnesses that were called at the hearing, intended to be called at the hearing, one was an attorney from Appleton who was killed in a car accident 7 days before the hearing. I made an offer of proof at the hearing and brought in an additional witness who was named who was familiar with the testimony of that attorney witness. The referee made no finding in response to my offer of proof. Essentially, his finding was that because Mr. Skotsky, the other witness, didn't have extensive knowledge of my disciplinary history, and one who's a non-lawyer would not be expected to have that information, that his testimony was incredible. The requirements for establishing moral character don't say that an attorney must call any particular witness or that it even has to be an attorney. But Mr. Skotsky did testify that he had knowledge of my conduct since the suspension, which is what the questionnaire had asked us to produce in terms of our witnesses. But the referee's decision seems to place too much emphasis on prior conduct or Mr. Skotsky's knowledge of that prior conduct.
What was your offer of proof with respect to the attorney from Appleton?
Well, the offer of proof through Mr. Skotsky is that Mr. Evers would have testified that he's known me for quite a period of time, both in and out of a courtroom setting, and that he was going to recommend reinstatement.
How did Mr. Skotsky know that?
He had spoken to him and asked him about it, and we had discussed it. all three of us and had discussed the issue. And I had also talked to Mr. Evers about possible representation in this case before his death, but I elected to use him as a witness.
Just a question. The referee's conclusion that you failed to call any favorable witnesses having credible evidence to offer. Now, you're disputing that, and I was in reading the both the briefs. It seemed to me that there was some kernel of truth in as far as any witnesses appearing to say that you had good moral character. I know that Judge Constantine, who you had listed, said that you had just appeared before him once, and he had no comment.
Correct.
So, from an affirmative standpoint, and you're in just responding to that, who testified favorably?
Mr. Skotsky, and through my offer of proof as to what Mr. Evers is deceased, obviously could not testify. But it was very clear that I made an offer of proof, and that was never ruled on, whether Mr. Evers' testimony would have been credible or not. But I believe Mr. Skotsky's testimony was uncontroverted, that he could recommend my reinstatement, and that he knew that Mr. Evers was going to recommend the same.
But what did Mr. Skotsky say about about the question? What did he testify to? Maybe I missed that.
He testified that he knew me, and that he knew that he could recommend me, that he would retain me as an attorney if I was practicing, although he hadn't had a need to retain me because he had never had any criminal problems. And essentially that he knew Bruce Evers, and Bruce was actually his business attorney, and that Bruce would have testified in favor of my reinstatement. And the only reason that these two witnesses were called is because I hadn't had contact living in Waupaca County with the other people, and they're requesting, in the questionnaire, they request witnesses who have seen you since the suspension and would be familiar with your conduct since the suspension.
What I'm referring to particularly, Mr. Carroll, is on page 4 of the red brief where I just made a note. It says, Skotsky provided no evidence as to Carroll's moral character or why he felt Carroll was fit to practice law.
Well, that first of all, there's no citation to that quote. It's just a subjective statement by OLR. So in my view, if you review the evidence of Mr. Skotsky, we established what the burden requires, which is that there's an affirmative recommendation that this person...
I'll follow up. Further on cross-examination, Skotsky admitted he has not reviewed the disciplinary decision and did not know much about Carroll's suspension and really did not talk to Carroll about it that much. That's R-47 at pages 290-92. And that's what I was referring to, sir.
Exactly, and I think that that's the... The statute doesn't, I don't believe, require that the witness have extensive knowledge of the prior conduct. And that's the whole point. The referee emphasized his lack of understanding of the decision. He testified that he knew that my discipline resulted from retainer issues. Retainage was the term that he used. So I believe that his testimony established the burden, and it was basically uncontroverted. And I don't know what more someone would say, you could possibly say.
How did you come to know Mr. Evers?
Bruce Evers? I have known him. I think I first met him at, in conjunction with some legal proceedings, I first met him, but then I met him again through friends in the Fox Valley area. And just became good friends.
How long did you know?
Probably about 6 years.
Now, most of your work in the past has been criminal defense, is that right?
Yes.
So you, in that role, you really haven't had to meet the burden of proof, I guess.
Correct.
Okay. So now you see what the prosecution has to do in a normal criminal case. Why didn't you find more people to come forward and testify to your good character?
I felt that two witnesses would be sufficient, and I felt that the burden required me to bring people that I had been interacting with since I was suspended on January 10th, 2002. And I hadn't interacted with anyone in the legal community in Milwaukee area during that time. So I felt that these were the only two people that could really testify on my behalf.
Were they required to be lawyers?
No.
Your witnesses?
No.
So you could have brought neighbors.
Sure, I could have brought neighbors.
Could have brought people with whom you do business on a personal level.
Which I did.
That was Mr.
Skotsky.
Skotsky.
Did I, when just following up on this, you had stated, and I had written down, you had called five people.
I had listed five witnesses.
As references.
As references. But
then the actual testimony boiled down to the one, Mr. Skotsky, and of course Mr. Evers is deceased.
Yes.
Okay.
Other than your witnesses, what concerns me is conduct that raises issues that you might have similar problems should you be readmitted. And one of these similar problems is dealing with money, especially in a trust account. And that there were findings and comments about your post-suspension trust account activity, whether you, something about an $8,000 debt that you owed or money that you were holding for someone who you could not locate. And there was like $20,000 in the trust account. So you revealed the $8,000, but not the $20,000. So there's an issue as to whether you should have revealed the $20,000 or that it was misleading by how you revealed only the $8,000, that it wound up the trust account was short funds and that you had to put in funds. So you get into this, why is it short? Because then the commingling, and this is all in terms of winding down this trust account, which ultimately was wound down. There's discussion as to whether you wound it down promptly enough, and your position is, I gather, no timeline was set forth. So how do you, it just makes, it makes a reader who reads both of the briefs concerned. And you say, well, my wife is learning how to do it better. But you're the one that's going to practice law. And you're careful to say you're not blaming her, which is a good idea. This concern, I mean, this is not rocket science, and you don't have to go to law school to understand there are segregated funds and they're not to be used except for segregated purposes. I mean, this is not very difficult. So what can you say that reassures me? Now, maybe I've misstated the facts, and tell me that. But if I've come somewhat close, and that's a perception I'm getting from all of this, what can you say to reassure me that we're not going to have additional problems on money.
I could just say briefly, since the hearing a year ago, I have become licensed in the real estate profession, and I am handling trust funds in that profession. It's not part of this record, but I now am licensed. All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that in my trust account practice, I didn't really have a mentor when I first started practicing law. I was an assistant district attorney in Manitowoc County, and then I went into private practice on my own.
What year was that, Mr. Carroll?
1989. So I didn't really have that much experience with it. But I did hire a woman who was in her 60s at that time who had worked for a lawyer that did estate planning trust work and was familiar with trust accounts. And basically what she taught me, I don't think any of the discipline or the principles, I understand how the trust account works and I know how it is supposed to work. The problem, I had a very large practice in Milwaukee that had a lot of cases. We had the clients very often were transient and addresses very often changed. The problem with the trust count, I think if you look at it from the, I knew I was going to be suspended because I didn't appeal the decision. OLR did originally on the disciplinary decision. So I knew for a year I had to get rid of or lay off 12 employees during that time period. I closed my office in Milwaukee and I had another office in Wind Lake, which is where I resided. There was a lot of things that had to be done in a short period of time. The cases that were open had to be closed. Refunds were given on, I think, 20 or so cases during that time period. No new cases were brought into the office, with the exception of maybe one or two that I knew I could handle. The trust account matters. When I received the December 11th letter from Mr. Weigel, which is a standard letter that goes out to a disciplined attorney as to what the requirements are, I knew that I had four clients that I hadn't located. Why did I know that? Because we have an active and a closed trust account. All the ledger cards were physically pulled if the account was active. In other words, if there was any money, it was in there. And we provided them with all the documentation of the efforts to locate these people. But when I actually went through the process of closing the account, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to locate them. Efforts had been made 2-3 years in the past. Since that time, I also had software that this all could have been recorded in on the software, but we were still using this manual system. With the billing system, we used a computerized system. So I think the concern there about whether some funds should be allocated would be addressed by the software that I intend to use, because it tells you right away whether this is client funds or not. In any event, Your Honor, I was clearly aware that a trust account had to be closed within 15 days of the suspension order. The other requirements, there were reams of paperwork that I sent to them that showed that I wasn't representing myself as an attorney. Letters to clients saying, I have an impending suspension, I can't handle your case, and referring them to other counsel, even sending refunds to the other counsel. In any event, when the trust account was actually closed, there were quite a few cases that I had settled. I settled, I think, 20 personal injury cases in the month of December. The checks came in the month of January, some on or after the date of suspension. So although I didn't act as an attorney, I had to distribute the funds at that time. So there was quite a few checks that were written. The referee is completely wrong about $20,000 in the account. There's a bank statement in the record that shows that the account had like $10,000 on the day of the conversation, and there was at least 8 undisbursed checks at that time. So the balance was $2,000. What happened was I wrote a check to myself, I believe it was on February, I don't recall the date, on a case by the name of Kyle Clavon. It was a $5,000 retainer fee on a criminal case. $2,500 was paid initially as a retainer fee. $2,500 went in the trust account. At this time, my traditional secretaries were no longer working for me. The trust ledger card indicated that the checks had all been written but voided. So it appeared when we were closing the trust account that $2,500 had been dispersed, had not been dispersed to us. So that was the mistake that we made. It was only because of that one disbursement that the other four clients who couldn't be located, that their funds were affected. And that I didn't discover that mistake until Mary Ahlstrom in February of 2003, after sending documents and asking me questions on it. So the account was not short in any by any means. I knew there may have also been problems with service charges. For example, there was a $300 charge for checks. We had these duplicate carbon checks on the trust account, which one of the secretaries I hired at the end there ordered. I said, she called me and said, we're out of checks, and she ordered them from the bank. So that was something that was taken out. But it came very close to the amount that was required. And if it wasn't for that mistake that we made, if you look and examine that physical ledger, you can see even Mary Ahlstrom, the investigator, testified that she could certainly see how the mistake was made.
Counselor, let me just interrupt you a minute. You said that that one of the reasons the trust account was off was because $300 worth of duplicate checks for that account had been purchased. But isn't that a business expense of yours? It isn't an expense of your clients in any case, is it?
Absolutely. Then that's
well, then why
that's
was the I'm sorry, but why was the money then deducted from the trust account? Why wasn't a check written from your own office account, like you'd pay your secretary with, to the bank to pay for those checks?
Ordinarily it would have been, but at that time, like I said, I had my employees were let go because of the suspension. Actually, they weren't let go. They received unemployment, and they didn't want to travel to Wind Lake. I hired another secretary who was very inexperienced. This was 2 weeks before the suspension order was issued on December 6th.
So you're saying that that was an error on the part of the secretary to just call the bank and order the checks and have them charged to that trust?
Well, my previous office manager wouldn't have done that. They would have found out the price of the checks, and we actually ordered them from a separate place. When you order from the bank, they charged you more. And that relates to, it also relates to why I had the word attorney on my personal account, because that account was open. When I moved to Appleton, my wife's bank was up there, and she didn't want to have to pay for new office operation checks when she knew on the business account from Milwaukee, when she knew that the suspension was coming. But we needed the checks, so the word attorney was added to her account. And that's undisputed, that the word attorney was on that account. But the referee, on that point, the referee was wrong on the escrow account, that once I discovered the Clavon error, I set up an escrow account after writing a letter to Mary Ahlstrom and suggesting that I do so to safeguard that money. She wrote me back and said, I don't want to offer you legal advice, but it would be consistent with the Supreme Court rules. And that account, clearly the referee was wrong. It does not say attorney on it. But the other account did. And that explains, I was trying to avoid incurring additional expenses on the trust and the operations account by adding the word attorney to a new bank account that my wife had in Appleton.
How long did you use that attorney account from the time you set it up, sir? The one that with the name attorney on it?
We never used the account when I was practicing, but it was set up in the fall of 2001. When we ran out of the checks on the operations account, the word attorney was struck from the checks.
When was that? How long was that?
I believe starting in January of 2002 it would have been.
How long have you been working in real estate?
Well, I've, as a licensee, only about 3 months. But I've been doing real estate investing for the last 2 years. That was actually why I got the license, because you can't do more than 5 transactions in a year without being licensed. So that was one of the reasons that I did it.
I assume that are you really practicing in real estate, or is it your own investments? Because what I'm driving at is, if you are really practicing, you will have clients, you will have activity in a trust account, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
You will have people who know whether you are of good moral character and being honest and forthright, or at least that they think you are. So what I want to know is, are you really practicing it, or are you investing for yourself, and therefore you're not going to have a clientele?
No, I definitely have a clientele. I'm selling real estate right now. But previous to being licensed, I didn't. But I'm selling commercial and real estate.
Okay.
So you're holding yourself out to the public as a real estate agent?
And yes.
In advertising under what is the company name, or what name do you use?
The real estate group, Coldwell Banker Commercial, is the company that I'm working with.
Oh, so you work with Coldwell Banker. You're under their auspices.
Yeah, they're the broker that I'm a salesperson, that they're the broker that holds my license. But I handle the trust fund and I give them to the broker on any transactions.
So if you get money for the sale, for earnest money for the sale of a piece of property, you give that check to then someone in Coldwell Banker's office and they take care of depositing it correctly, is that right?
That's correct.
And then the Coldwell Banker is the one who does the closing statements, reconciliation of funds received and expended?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. I believe my time is up.
Your time is up, Mr. Carroll, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. You can lower the podium if you like.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Julie Falk, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the present reinstatement proceeding. Carroll appears to forget that as a suspended attorney, he has the burden of proof in this proceeding to prove that he meets the requirements of SCR 22.31 by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. Carroll has the burden to prove that he has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin. Carroll has the burden to prove that his resumption of the practice of law will not be detrimental to the administration of justice or subversive to the public interest.
I just want to talk about the moral character issue now. Here,
sure.
Here he had one witness and then one the attorney Evers, who was deceased, and you questioned that type of testimony. How many witnesses does a person need to prove good moral character? Is there is one sufficient, or do we need five or six? Or
I don't believe that there's a magic number that you have to have in order to prove that you're fit to practice law or that you have the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin. The problem with the witnesses that Carroll had presented to prove that he's fit to practice law failed to provide any reasoning or basis as to why Carroll had the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin or why he was fit to practice law in Wisconsin. The referee was not clearly erroneous in concluding that Carroll failed to provide any favorable witnesses having credible evidence to offer to prove that he has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin.
Counselor, how would you prove that? I mean, what should his witness have said that he didn't say?
Well, all the witnesses testified to, and if I could go to the examples, for example, Bruce Evers, in regards to what he would have presented at the reinstatement proceeding, Carroll Ott made an offer of proof. The only thing that Carroll stated was that Evers knew him, and Evers believes that Carroll could be recommended to the bar to have Carroll's license reinstated. The only testimony presented by Steve Skotsky, when asked if he was aware that Evers was going to testify, recommending Carol to the state bar was, yes, from what I've heard. We haven't discussed it a lot, but I did hear that. Yes. There was no testimony presented as to what Bruce Evers would have testified to, whether or not he would have even testified that Carol was fit to practice law in Wisconsin, or whether Evers even had the opinion that he had the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin. The only testimony presented was that they were aware that he was going to recommend Carol to the state bar, period.
They were aware that Evers was going to recommend reinstatement?
Correct.
And Evers was a lawyer, so we should probably presume that he knew that having good moral character was certainly one of those criteria, correct?
Well, I think you need more testimony than just stating, though, that that's what he was going to testify to. I think you need some sort of understanding or some sort of foundation for why he believed that Carol was, why he would recommend Carol to the state bar.
Counsel?
I'm sorry.
Justice Rokensack, are you finished?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Go ahead. Thank
Counsel,
you.
Counsel, I want to focus on the referee's report and recommendations in my questions. The conclusion of law number 33 with regard to the testimony and moral character indicated that the petitioner failed to call any favorable witnesses having credible evidence to offer. That's the conclusion of law. The finding of fact, which I assume, and maybe I'm overlooking something, the finding of fact that supports that conclusion of law is, excuse me, finding of fact one regarding the testimony of Mr. Schatzky. And again, please correct me if I'm missing something. That finding of fact says that Mr. Schatzky testified that the petitioner was fit to practice law. From that sentence, I do not conclude that he was incredible in that statement. The next sentence says, however, on cross-examination, the witness admitted that he knew very little, if anything, about the previous disciplinary proceedings leading to the suspension of Mr. Carroll's license, number one, and number two, only knew the petitioner as a friend of 6 or 7 years, never having retained or observed him in a legal setting. So as I read finding number one, as it fits with no credible evidence conclusion, in conclusion number three, that although Mr. Schatzky testified that petitioner was fit to practice law, the referee apparently thought it was incredible because, number one, he didn't know anything about the prior suspensions. Number two, he had known him for only 6 or 7 years. And three, he had never retained or observed petitioner in a legal setting. Are either of those three things required to constitute credible evidence regarding moral character?
Well, I believe that not each single one of these would be required, but I believe it was the overall presentation of the witness. The referee is the eyes and ears of this court. The referee listened to the testimony of Steve Schatzky, listened to what he had to say, and found that he was not a credible witness.
I can understand that, but in looking at the referee's report, since I'm not there in the referee and I wasn't there listening to the testimony, I need something, I think, to show me why it's incredible, you know, because if the referee says it's incredible, you know, I'll say, given our standard of review, it's incredible, but I need something to support that, you know. The guy was lying, the guy never, you know, I need something. And the three things given seem to me, either together or separately, none of them make the witness incredible. So why is there the conclusion of law that there's no credible evidence regarding his moral character. I have problems with that.
Well, if you look at his first conclusion regarding Mr. Skotsky, he did testify that Carroll was fit to practice law. Carroll had asked him whether or not he would make a recommendation that Carroll would be fit to practice law in the state. He responded, definitely yes. However, that's all he testified to. He didn't testify as to why he believed that Carroll was fit to practice law, what actions Carroll has represented to him that would give him that opinion. It was just a bald statement, uncorroborated statement, that he was fit to practice law. The only testimony he presented is that he's known Carroll for 6 to 7 years and they're good friends.
Why doesn't that give him a basis to believe he's fit to practice law? If you know someone for 6 or 7 years and you're a good friend, which would imply that you've spent a fair amount of time with one another over those 6 or 7 years, why isn't that a foundation for the opinion that Mr. Carroll is fit to practice law?
Because I believe that he needs to present more testimony as to a foundation for why he feels that way.
What did he need to say? If you were speaking for him, what should he have said that's missing from this record?
I believe that just a plain statement that he's fit is not sufficient.
I understand that, but tell me what you think is missing.
I believe he should have testified that, you know, they were good friends for 6 to 7 years. He knows him through this capacity, that he believes that he's fit and he has a moral character to practice law because of examples of actions that Carroll has represented to him through their relationship, that he's interacted with people in a certain way, or that, you know, Carroll is a very honest person, or that he knows him to be an honest person.
Okay, so what you're telling me really is that his testimony was conclusory, but not factual enough, right?
Correct.
Okay. Did anybody object to the conclusion that he made without this foundation that OLR thinks should have been there?
Well, under the Supreme Court rules, the rules of evidence are not to be are not applicable to reinstatement proceedings.
So the answer is nobody objected. They let him state his conclusion, and then after it was all over, they said the conclusion was too conclusory. We needed more facts.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Even if the evidence ruled applied, you can have opinion evidence.
And I think it's important with regards to Steve Skotsky's testimony that he hadn't discussed anything with regard to the disciplinary proceeding with John Miller Carroll. When asked if he had knowledge of the disciplinary action, he testified, "No, I really don't." He did indicate in his testimony that all I know is some retainage. Like I said, he, you know, John told me it was incorrect. But that's all I know. And he also testified that he never retained Carroll in the past, has not observed him in a legal setting. And contrary to Carroll's assertions, he never said that he would be willing to retain Carroll in the future for representation.
Did OLR stake out a position before the hearing ever began?
The OLR completes their investigation, and they ask John Miller Carroll, they send him a questionnaire, they ask him a lot of questions about what he's done during his suspension period, and then we're required to submit a response to his petition for reinstatement, whether or not we feel that he's met the requirements.
What was your response?
Our response was that we did not feel he met the requirements based upon the same reasons that the referee found a denial of reinstatement in this proceeding. The Office of Lawyer Regulation found that Carroll had engaged in numerous trust account violations during his period of suspension.
Counsel, I just want to go back to the questions on moral character before we get very quickly. I noticed that a judge was named by Mr. Carroll as a reference. And I think the judge said, as Judge Charles Constantine, this is in the referee's report on page 3, that the petitioner had appeared in his court on one occasion on a pro se basis to collect legal fees and nothing more. That seemed to get at least a comment from the referee as far as using that person as a reference where there was only one, says one contact with that
right. The referee did present a letter to the OLR investigator during our reinstatement investigation. He indicated that Carroll appeared before him once during his period of suspension to collect his fees. I believe that was in the Shoup matter. Mr. Shoup did testify at the hearing. Mr. Carroll.
He testified negatively, right?
Yes. Mr. Carroll could have presented that judge at the hearing to testify on his behalf. He chose not to.
Counsel, you made some reference in response to a question that there have been trust account violations during suspension.
Correct.
And one of the things that's been going through my mind is this from perspective of OLR just a failure to prove kind of case, you know, a failure to meet your burden, because that's the way you started the argument, or are there reasons independent of failure of the plaintiff to carry his burden that you think that he should not be reinstated? I'm making a little longer preface to perhaps focus my point. That is, I look at a prior case where we denied reinstatement, William A. Wenzel, back in 1994. And this court was concerned, as we sometimes are with denials for reinstatement, we denied because while he was suspended, he continued to engage in activities that constituted the practice of law, that he failed to comply with the court rules in respect of informing his clients and others that he was suspended, that he demonstrated a lack of proper understanding of the law, and he demonstrated that he is unwilling or unable to act in conformity with the standards of the legal practice. So there were reasons, you know, like it wasn't just he failed to, you know, call enough witnesses, but they were, you know, he was practicing law. He wasn't notifying his clients that he was suspended. What reasons akin to that was done, or what do you have that occurred during suspension? And you just mentioned something. He had trust account violations. So I want you to focus on what those violations were during suspension.
Sure. There's multiple violations here that occurred during the suspension over and above John Miller Carroll's burden to prove that he's entitled to reinstatement. First, as the referee properly found, he failed to properly operate and promptly close his trust account. It's based upon the facts that on December 11, 2001, John Miller Carroll received a letter reminding him of his obligations under 2226. The letter specifically stated to John Miller Carroll that he should make all appropriate disbursements from the client's trust account and close the same. SCR 2226 requires a suspended attorney to make the arrangements for either the temporary or the permanent closing of an attorney's practice.
May I just to short-circuit it? One of the responses, then, Mr. Carroll offers is, look, I had an extension, and that there was no deadline to that extension, no firm deadline to the extension, and indeed it was closed in June. How do you respond to that?
Based upon OLR's correspondence, they did not specifically indicate to Carroll that he had an extension to keep his trust account open. I believe the conversation between the OLR and Carroll was, I have this $8,000. I need to get it to two clients who I cannot locate. The OLR indicated in that conversation that they would do what they could to assist Carroll in locating these clients and disperse those funds so that he could close his trust account. I think it's also important to note that Carroll did find these clients and disperse the funds on April 12, 2002. He did not close his trust account until June 15, 2002, 2 months later.
Okay, so that's That's one problem. Another problem referenced by the referee is commingling of funds. And right. That phrase, of course, conjures up real bad stuff. You can't commingle funds. But my concern was this. Please address it. My concern was, on the commingling of funds was this, that apparently there was a shortfall and in the trust account, and Carroll put his own money in the trust account to take care of the shortfall, and that was the commingling of funds. I mean, normally we see it the other way. You're taking clients' money out rather than taking your own money, putting it in the trust account. Is that – previously, has that been determined under our law to be commingling of funds?
Yes. Yes, I don't have a specific cite to any cases, but I believe that that would be considered the commingling of funds under SCR 20:1.15. There is an exception in that rule for an attorney to place his own funds in that account to cover minimal service charges. For example, if they're charged a $25 fee every month as a service charge, that attorney is allowed to deposit $25 of his own money in that account for those service charges.
What was he supposed to do if he wanted to I mean, you know, he messed up. Let's say, you know, bad trust account. What is he supposed to do if he wants to take care of his client and kind of, you know, get this taken care of? Does he say to the client, well, I've got the money, and I'd like to pay you, put it in the trust account and pay you, better to go and get a small claims judgment or something so that I don't commingle funds? How is that handled? I don't know.
Well, it could have easily been handled by him just transferring the funds from his trust account to his checking account and cutting checks to the clients.
Well, isn't that that's the thing you don't want to do, though, isn't it? Isn't that commingling, taking your trust account monies and putting it in your own checking account? I mean, that I would think is a problem.
Correct. It's hard to say exactly what he should do with the $1,000 shortfall. It's important to emphasize here, though, that his account wouldn't have been short if he would have properly operated his trust account in the first instance. He would have never ran into this problem. His account, it's undisputed that his account, there's a chart that was put together by the OLR investigator that shows the exact status of his account throughout his suspension period. It's clear that his account was short funds in approximately the amount of $700 the entire period of his suspension. So despite the fact that he even converted the 23-43-43 in regards to the Clavon matter, even at that point he still would not, even if he would have deposited that back into his account, he still would not have had sufficient funds in his trust account to cover all the money attributable to his clients. This could have easily been remedied by doing exactly what the OLR investigator did, was recreate the account, look through all the trust account ledgers, figure out exactly what was owed to the clients on a monthly basis, and compare that with the balance in his bank account, and he failed to do that.
One final question in this area, because the reason I focus on what violations were done during suspension is, as I recall, the reason for his one-year suspension, in part, were four counts dealing with trust accounts. So I have no problem in understanding that he had trust account violations and he was suspended for those for a year. And so I don't want to mix up what he's already received discipline for from what occurred during the suspension. So he had the commingling of funds, number one, when he put his own money in to pay. From your perspective, number two, he was late in closing the account.
He failed to properly close and promptly disperse funds to his clients.
And other trust account violations during suspension include what?
He converted funds. in the Klavan matter, and he also failed to maintain sufficient funds in his trust account during the period of suspension. And just to mention that, and what else he could have done in terms of the $1,000 is he could have cut a check to the client for the amount that he had in his trust account and then maybe cut a separate check for the difference to that client from his business account. I mean, there were ways to avoid commingling of funds. He also failed to properly reconcile his account. As I had emphasized previously, if he had created a monthly ledger doing a tally of what on a monthly basis he owed all of his clients in his trust account or what would have been attributable to those clients in his trust account, he would have realized that he did not have sufficient funds in his trust account to cover all amounts due and owing or attributable to his clients. And I think it's important to note also that his previous disciplinary history coupled with this present misconduct just evinces a failure of John Miller Carroll to understand his duties and obligations with regard to the trust account rules and his fiduciary obligations to his clients. He's had previous discipline for trust account violations. He's had previous discipline for failure to return retainer fees or maintain those fees in his trust account. At this point, he should understand the duties of an attorney with regard to the trust account rules and his fiduciary duties to his clients.
Ms. Falk, oftentimes when there's reinstatement, there's a monitoring of the attorney in regard to the trust account, sometimes for as long as 2 or 3 years. Why isn't that sufficient in this case?
Because, again, it's our position that Carroll has failed to meet his burden for numerous reasons. He's failed to present by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he's entitled to reinstatement based upon the trust account violations, based upon his leaving attorney John Miller Carroll on his bank statement throughout the period of his suspension. He was still using that account in February of 2003 during OLR's investigation after the expiration of the term of his suspension, and he still failed to change his name on that account. It's disturbing when asked whether or not he could have just called the bank and changed the title attorney on that account. He said, "I didn't know I was supposed to do that." He also...
Counselor, if the trust account were my major focus and we were to require Attorney Carroll to have a CPA, someone in charge of making all the deposits, all the reconciliations of the bank statements, and all of the payments out of that account, much like Coldwell Banker does for his real estate transactions, would that satisfy OLR's concern for the public?
Well, the OLR also has a concern that Carroll just doesn't understand his obligations and fiduciary duties as an attorney, and I don't know if just having an accountant look over his trust account will remedy that.
Well, I don't mean look it over. I mean hire him to be responsible for making the deposits, writing the checks, and reconciling the bank statements so that he hires independent help to do that.
Well, and Attorney Carroll, though, is still responsible for his clients and
right,
for his fiduciary obligations, and he still would be advising the accountant as to what funds should be dispersed and when those funds should be in trust and when they should be in his business account. I don't know if an accountant would take care of all those obligations for him.
So it's not satisfactory, is it?
No.
That's the bottom line. Okay, thank you.
And he has evidence throughout the proceeding a failure to understand his obligations by just even certain comments that he's made. He, throughout the proceeding, emphasized that his account was a pooled account, and he had plenty of money in his account if he hadn't taken his own attorney's fees. He also emphasized that it was difficult with this type of account to know exactly where the money is coming from. All you have to know is what your outstanding liabilities are and what your balance is. When he deposited $1,000 of his own funds, he believed that by making the deposit, he actually complied with the rule. And when closing the account with funds owed to four clients, he said, "It's true, you know, that I literally closed the account. Those people hadn't been paid, but at the time we didn't know about the Klavan mistake, okay?" He emphasized that he actually believes he did his clients a favor by attempting to locate them during the time of suspension. He also indicated that he had plenty of time to locate his clients, and he wasn't sitting around all summer thinking about it. He doesn't understand that it was his obligation upon his suspension to promptly locate these clients and properly disperse their funds. Carroll urges this court that a denial of reinstatement would be too severe, but it's not too severe in this case. He cannot compare his case with that of Sidney Eisenberg, who engaged in one misconduct violation during his suspension, where he appeared in front of an insurance commissioner on behalf of his corporation. Sidney Eisenberg informed the insurance commissioner that he was not acting as an attorney, and the referee found in that case that Sidney Eisenberg sincerely believed that he was not violating his terms of suspension. Although the referee in that case recommended a denial of reinstatement, he urges this court to reconsider his decision based upon Eisenberg's sincerity. The referee did not do that in this case. To allow Carroll to be reinstated where he has failed to meet his burden under SCR 22.31 would contravene the purpose of the Supreme Court rules, which requires every attorney suspended for over 6 months to prove by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he or she is entitled to reinstatement. The referee's determination that Carroll has failed to meet his burden is substantiated based upon the fact that he did fail to provide credible witnesses showing that he was fit to practice law or that he had the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin. He engaged in numerous trust account violations during his suspension. He continued to represent to the bank that he was Attorney John Miller Carroll throughout his entire suspension term. Instead of rectifying his misconduct, Carroll further argues that he wants to avoid one of the major problems in the past by having a non-refundable retainer agreement. The referee properly concluded that his non-refundable retainer agreement flirts with violating SCR 20:1.16D and SCR 20:1.5A. And despite the fact that Carroll has been disciplined in the past for trust account and fee violations, Carroll has failed to take his obligations seriously or his fiduciary duties to his clients seriously and has failed to comprehend what's required of him as a member of the bar. Consequently, the OLR requests that this court accept the recommendation of the referee and deny Carroll's petition for reinstatement. Thank you.
Ms. Falk, do you think, yes. When is he eligible to reapply?
9 months after the denial of his reinstatement. So once the court...
Denial by whom? By the court?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carroll?
Brief as possible. With respect to the moral character issue and the basis for Mr. Skotsky's testimony, on page 3 of my reply brief, I cite the language that I believe provided the foundation for the Mr. Skotsky's testimony. It says that he did, quote, testify that he had been discussed with him, in other words, the rule violations, and he knew of the basic violations against Carroll. And that's cited at page 291 through 295 of the transcript. With regard to the trust account violations, Justices, first of all, the testimony in this hearing, was largely undisputed that the trust account could remain open. For the first time in this case, in her brief, she's arguing that I didn't have permission to keep the trust account open. The reason that the trust account remained open is because I had to personally drive to Milwaukee to close the account. The Shaws were located, they were found on April 12th, but the checks didn't clear until April 28th. There were still, at that time, outstanding checks, so I couldn't go and close the account immediately. I had to drive to Milwaukee and close the account. And I was down there in June, and that's when it was closed. In addition, there's no question, if you look at Exhibit 10...
You'll have to stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry,
so we can't record you.
Exhibit 10 is a letter that Mr. Weigel sent me in March, and it indicates that I am to leave the funds in trust. And by implication, this letter and the letter that he sent me in February clearly imply that I was to keep this account open indefinitely until they were located. The mistake that I made was closing the account without dispersing those four smaller sums, which, by the way, when you add them up, are all less than the amount that I converted, unintentionally converted, which I found out a year later. So there was a surplus of $300 in there at least. And I don't know where she gets that figure of $700 from. That's from based on their own exhibit. In terms of the transferring the funds by way of a business check, that's also the first time that that argument has been made. I was advised by Mr. Weigel that I must send a trust account check to these clients. And when they were the primary amount of money that was still in the account. When I said I was doing them a favor, what I was referring to was they were out of state. They had retained me from St. Louis. The money would have been sent to the treasurer as abandoned property, and I knew they wouldn't have received it. So I said I was doing them a favor by doing this. She quotes it out of context like she does in her entire brief, the statements that I made. The statement about the bank, when I said I didn't know I was required to do that, what I was referring to was the fact that I had to actually make a phone call rather than removing the name attorney, the word attorney, from the bank statement. But by crossing off the word attorney if the checks were used, and they were satisfied at that point that I wasn't representing myself as an attorney. So I made a mistake. My wife handles my financial matters, and we didn't remove the word attorney from that account. But the checks were not used in conjunction with any kind of law practice. And by the way, no one at the bank ever said anything about it to me. It wasn't used to extend a line of credit. I had already established that on separate accounts. In terms of the conversion, the referee's finding is clearly error. He says in the hearing that it wasn't client funds, and then in his decision he says that it's client funds regarding that Clavon matter. Even they don't dispute that it wasn't client funds. With regard to this entire matter, I wish I had had more time, but I would have liked to go into more detail on some of the errors that I believe occurred. But if you read my brief, they're very, very specific, and I try to do it in as few pages as possible. The decision is just filled with mistakes, and their physical documents will controvert what he says in his findings. The referee did not address the issue of whether or not the trust fund problems could be remedied at all, and he didn't consider that remedy at all. And I think that was also error if you look at the cases that are cited. In the cases that OLR cites, I think, first of all, if you read the Webster case, the referee, he lifts basically the language of your opinion into this decision. So it indicates to me that he basically copied your decision rather than quoting from it selectively. And so I would just ask that you consider the errors that are there, and also that the severity of this is really more like a revocation than a one-year suspension, given the length of time that's passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Thank you, Ms. Falk. for your arguments this morning on this reinstatement issue. That closes our hearing on 00-1426D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John Miller Carroll. Is Mr. Zales here? I'm talking about the next case. We'll take a couple of minutes recess for counsel to appear and for students to be brought in. We're in recess for a few moments.